Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 94. 94.
Oh my goodness.
I've got the pleasure of having two of my wonderful co-workers with me in the intro. We've got Melissa.
Hello.
And Sean.
Hello.
Hello.
I was going to say hello for Melissa. Like, what?
Hello.
It's going to confuse everybody.
I need to set Melissa. My English
hey,
accent.
This is Melissa.
Hello, I'm English.
Yes, you are. All right, so who is on the podcast today in episode 94?
Eric Stoltz.
That's right. The actor?
No.
Not the
Much
actor.
To my chagrin, but I'm sure.
No, does he work at Gensler?
He does work at Gensler. Very good, Melissa.
Smooth.
Very good. And Gensler is a...
Architecture firm.
That's right. It's a very large architecture firm. In fact, one of the largest architecture firms in the world, if not the largest. I think it is the largest. It's like over 5,000 people and over 40 offices around the world. Something crazy like that.
That's amazing.
Yeah, they're really amazing. And that's where actually I got my first job as an architect. It was at Gensler.
Oh.
And that's where I first met Eric 18 years ago. That's how long ago.
Oh, my goodness.
I wasn't even born.
Oh, God.
Yeah. He's a really cool guy. He went to SciArc here in LA. That's where he went to school. He practiced architecture under Eric Owen Moss. So a lot of the buildings that you and I see every day, he was one of the designers on those buildings.
Very
and worked
cool.
on that stuff. And he also, interestingly, designed the interior to Sony ImageWorks. So ImageWorks offices, he did those things. Then he went to the DC office and for Gensler, and now he's in the LA office. And he is a principal over there as well as a design director. A really nice guy. I've known him for years. We talk about a lot of cool stuff and really great talk. But let's talk about a couple of announcements. VR scans.
Yeah, that was a biggie this week.
Yeah? What happened on VR scans?
Sean... blasted social media.
Sweeped. Yeah. I did a social sweep.
Yeah. So a lot of stuff went out. So VR scans is on our website. So you should go check out. So just go to chaosgroup.com and check out the VR scan stuff.
It's material scanning for anyone that doesn't know.
Right.
By the way.
So it's a scanner, as some of you may or may not know, that allows us to scan materials and create complete BRDFs or textured BRDFs, should we say. So it's a pretty impressive technology. And the demos that you can see on our website sort of really showcase why this thing is pretty amazing. Events happening, right?
Yeah, there's V-Ray Days Italy happening right now.
Right, October 25th to the 5th.
Yeah, I'm a bit jealous. I'm not there, actually.
Yeah.
I'll have to put in for that trip next year.
Yeah, and then we have another V-Ray Days trip happening in India, right?
Yeah, that's coming up soon.
Yeah, November 8th through the 19th. Okay. So those are some good things. So check out our page chaosgroup.com/events and check out the events that are happening there.
There's lots of news about the schedule and different speakers that are talking at those.
Right.
So you can find all of that information on our website.
Absolutely. That's great. And then, of course, today, or will be when this podcast comes up, will be Halloween. So I want to wish happy Halloween to everyone.
We need like a scary laugh now.
Halloween's on Monday. Oh, yeah.
This comes out on Monday.
It comes out on Sunday night.
It comes out Sunday LA time, but for people in Europe, it'll be Monday. But anyway, it should be Halloween by the time people listen to this. What are you dressing up for Halloween, Sean?
Oh, God. I don't know.
Really? I'm going to be Jack Skellington probably again.
Yeah?
Yeah. Pretty good at that tall, skinny guy. Got a big white head.
I'm going to wear my blow-up dinosaur costume.
You have one?
You know
You've
I have one.
Seen it.
I'd wear it every day to work if I was allowed.
That's awesome.
That's what I need.
I want that. That would be so cool. So that's really great. And then, of course, the other thing that's coming is it looks like, you remember when we talked about a while ago, we're going to try to do something special for the 100th episode?
That's why I was like, this is amazing that this is number 94 already.
Right.
And 100's not far away.
Yeah, and I think we're not gonna make any promises, but I think it's gonna be something really special.
There's
so
something up your Steve.
Yeah.
Steve.
What's up your Steve?
Oh, goodness.
Cool. Who's Steve?
What's up with Steve?
All right, guys. Thanks a lot. Hopefully this intro went pretty well. Eric, we love you. This is a great podcast, and thanks so much, guys.
Bye.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays In high dynamic range, we know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
We should, I guess, let people know that you were not Eric Stoltz that was fired from Back to the Future.
No. I am not. Although I think I got his Rolling Stone subscription for about 2 months when I was at UCLA.
I told Sean, is like, yeah, Eric Stoltz is coming by for a podcast. And he goes like, oh my God. ask him about masks. How was Cher? Yeah.
That was the worst association when people, you know, in the early days, that was the only thing anybody knew his name for. And so
was Mask.
Like, yeah. It was like, oh, you're that really disfigured guy, right?
Yeah. Well, you're not that person. You're a person who I've known for 98. Since before I 98.
Yep.
So we're looking at 18 years now.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you came in.
I came in 98.
You came in 98, and I'd been at Gensler for maybe a year.
Right.
And we started what was called the 3DM group at that time.
Yeah.
And you missed the first round that we did.
We should tell people what that was, because let's think about that. This is 1998, 18 years ago.
Yep.
And Gensler, this is when I was introduced to a cool thing at Gensler, was that they showed me their simplified org chart, in a sense, which was actually kind of nice, right? Especially from a young guy just graduating college, never really worked in a big place and stuff like that. But this was Jim Furr at the time, and who was the head of the Gensler office in Houston, and he came up
just to retired.
He just retired, yeah.
Just retired.
And he told me, so he told me about the fact that there was a consulting firm, and I can't remember the name of the consulting firm that came in and came
McKinsey.
Up with, McKinsey.
Yeah.
Came up with the term, the one firm. And the reason behind this is that he was finding lots of large architecture firms, because it's a service industry and it's competitive. Certain offices were competing against other offices of the same firm for the same project.
Sure. And the classic story was always new SOM.
SOM.
The SOM, their Chicago and New York offices were entering the same competitions, and neither one of them would back down, and they would end up submitting on the same competition.
And that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So he came up with this idea, the one firm, and the way to, or the McKinsey did, and Gensler really embraced it. This is one of the only times I've seen a consulting firm come in and give you a plan, and it was actually implemented and implemented well.
Yeah, and they came in with two ideas. One was the one firm.
Right.
And I don't actually remember stories of that being part of what they did. The other half was the practice areas and having us focus
on expertise. That's what I was just getting at, right? So the way he did it, he showed me this graph, which was a two-way graph, right? So on the horizontal or the columns were all the different offices.
Yep.
And vertically were the horizontally, or the rows were different specialty groups.
Right.
So there'd be like people who are experts in airports, or people who are experts in workspace, or then people who are experts in project management, people who are experts in design, et cetera, et cetera. And then we were like this new group, probably the youngest group.
Definitely the youngest
group. Definitely the youngest group.
They got concerned when we did our trips that we didn't have enough people that were 21 to drive rent cars.
Right. I think you have to be 25 to run a
25,
car.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, we were the youngest group. We were the craziest group, generally speaking. We would basically, we'd meet every 6 months, was it?
We'd get on calls frequently. But
we get on calls at least once a week or once every couple of weeks.
Yeah, once a year they let us have a retreat and we'd go to a different city.
Right.
We'd go to a baseball game and we'd sit around and
and
geek out about software and hardware and what was happening.
Yeah, it was like our own little mini SIGGRAPH.
Yeah.
And each office had one or two representatives, depending on the size of the office.
Yep.
And we'd all get together, and we all knew each other, and we became close friends in a lot of ways. And you were included. Like, you were not in the Houston office, but you were in the
I was in D.C.
at the time. You were in a D.C. office at the time. You and
Jordan.
Jordan. That's right. And so you and I would talk all the time after that. I would get on the phone with you and just pick up the phone and talk to Eric about whatever.
Yeah, it was funny because the number of people in the entire firm, and the firm was still one of the largest at the time.
Right.
At maybe 1,200 people across the firm.
Right.
But we were spread thin, and the number of people who actually had real expertise in doing 3D or rendering or anything else that was multimedia was fairly small. And so you couldn't get that synergy and that kind of critical mass in a single office.
Right.
And so allowing us to come together across the firm and have shared experiences really helped to evolve that at the firm.
I also think it sort of made us excited to go back and say, oh, look at this crazy thing they're doing in the Denver office or whatever, you know, or Chicago or whatever. Chicago is huge now, my God, because I remember we did one in Chicago and it was a kind of a smallish office.
Yeah.
Now it's bigger than I remember the Houston office. It's huge.
Yeah, they're well over 200 now.
Wow.
They might even be at 300, but Houston, you know, with the energy, with the price of gas going down.
Right.
They're diving down a little bit, but it's you know, every office is big now. The number of offices that are over 100 people around the firm is almost half of them.
Wow.
It's outrageous.
And what's the size of the firm now?
We're 5,200 people, something
Jesus.
Like that. And Costa Rica is like 120.
Costa Rica is 120 people?
Costa Rica is 120 people. They were supposed to be an insourcing office that would do, you know, basically, you know, you've got much cheaper labor in China and places like that. And so some people would send all their documents out there, and we said, well, we don't want to send it outside the firm. So Costa Rica had a really great, you know, education base, and so we had some real strong connections down there. And so we started an office mainly for what we call insourcing.
What do you define insourcing?
So you're trying to do a project, and you'll do the design work locally, but to actually do the documents, you can send that to a place that's maybe – charge a lot less per hour for that labor there.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would send the drawings down to Costa Rica, and you still have oversight from the office that was doing it originally, but the office in Costa Rica would do it for maybe half the price of what you would do it in whatever that city was. So cost of labor in San Francisco and LA is really high compared
to
there. So,
well, that's amazing. So, you know, it's interesting, sort of thinking back to some of the Gensler things. Obviously, it's a huge firm, as we said, but there was one thing that I always struck with me is that being part of a large firm does not necessarily take away from your creativity or your the ability to do innovative things. Because, and here's the reason what I discovered is that because it's so large, there's so many people that actually take care of things that you would have to take care of in a small firm, right?
Yep.
You have to do much more less administrative stuff.
Yeah.
Because that's taken care of for you by other people.
Certainly at that level, that's absolutely true. And unfortunately now I'm a little higher. I've been like 90% of my day is emails and
talk. Sure. And so is mine. And that sucks because, you know, people ask me V-Ray questions and it's hard because I don't actually open V-Ray as much as I used to.
Yeah.
I know a lot of stuff, but I haven't actually, I haven't done shots in forever, you know, just like you haven't sat down and done a CAD drawing or doing a rendering. You were talking about the fact that you started rendering. It's like, oh, the time I actually get to do some rendering is amazing. But you're a vice president now.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry, vice presidents shouldn't be sitting down and playing with V-Ray.
Yes, they should. They absolutely should. If I could just sit down and 3D model and render all day, boy, that would be...
You can do that as a hobby.
I'd love to do that, yeah.
Yeah. And get you a license of V-Ray for home, no problem.
If my wife saw me doing that for fun at home, that would not go over well.
That would not go over well? Yeah. I don't know. I think it'd be fun. But anyway, so another thing that's funny, we should go back to some of your past, because it was funny. You said it's a crazy that you are here, like right, you know, we're in the Hayden Corridor, as they call it, which is the Eric Owen Moss explosion happened, right?
Yep. This was...
That's where you started or...
So...
You went to SIARC, right?
I went to SIARC. I got a job with Eric while I was in school. Jay Vanos hired me and...
So was Eric Owen Moss part of SciArc or sort of a professor there?
He was an instructor at the time.
Yep.
He was, after I left, he became director of the school for 15 years and helped him buy the place over downtown. So I was working in his office while I was in school. There was a little bit of a downturn. I went away for a little bit. Then when I graduated, I joined back up with him for a few years. I introduced computers into his office.
Okay. Kind of like the way Mark did a little bit with Morphosis.
Sure.
What do you mean? Yeah. They were hand drawing everything?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Everything was done by hand drawing at the time. And I had taken descriptive geometry at SciArc, and Jay Vanas taught that class.
Sure.
And I was really drawn to it because, you know, when I decided to become an architect, the things that were interesting to me were basically complicated geometry shaped buildings. And Eric was kind of at the time was at the forefront of doing some of those pieces. And so I gravitated there, but they were doing everything by hand. And I had taught myself AutoCAD in another job and started experimenting with the 3D as soon as it came out in AutoCAD 10. And they needed to control some of the kind of geometry points in space. Mm-hmm. It was much harder to do by hand. And so I started building everything in 3D in AutoCAD 10. And we would take measurements from that. But you had to build everything wireframe. There was no solid modeling.
Right.
And there were no real modeling tools at all. So used all the same skills I'd learned in doing descriptive geometry, literally to like rotate UCSs and find points in space, and especially to find intersections of lines in space.
Right.
So he found it valuable just to be able to get critical dimensions.
Okay.
And so we used to do these things called critical dimension drawings in the office that were just like every single core element of the geometry detailed out in one drawing, plan, section, elevation, all laid on top of each other. And then we would extract all that to do the drawing of all the different sections and plans and everything from
Interesting.
That. And for me, as I was doing it, I was like, you know, this is dumb. We're doing it all in 2D because I can do this all in the computer and I can represent it in 3D space. And we don't have to kind of draw it three times because you draw it an elevation on two sides and you're drawing a plan. So let's just do it one time.
And then you just do a camera that represents each one or an orthogonal view of it.
Yeah. And the critical thing at the time was just to take measurements. You know, where do these two places hit in space and to find that? And so, we had a computer in the office. I was the only guy who ran it. Eric didn't want to see the computer at all because he was much like almost all of SciArc, they did not like computers. Didn't want it in there at all.
Huh.
I wasn't allowed to use it for any of the classes I was taking. And this was 90. You know, I graduated in 92.
Right. You know what's interesting is you graduated in 92. So and. But you went for a B-Arc at that point? You didn't go for an M-Arc, right?
I did. So I had started at UCLA, went 3 years in computer engineering.
Okay.
And after 3 years, realized I hated it and decided to start over and be an architect. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't give me any credit for any of the classes. So I did 5 years of a B-Arc.
Okay. So you did as much time as an M-Arc, but you got a B-Arc.
That's right.
You wasted 3 years doing computer science.
8 years for one degree. That's right.
All right. Well, I did an M-Arc. I did 4 years in undergrad, and then I did 3.5 years unrelated to architecture. So I did 3.5 years to get my M-Arc. But I got, and I'm sure you had them too. I had Robert Mangurian and Marianne Ray coming as guest speakers.
Yeah, never had them. They were mostly in the graduate program because he ran the graduate program.
So they were crazy.
Yeah.
And I could definitely sense, since I came from SciArc, that they were not really into the computer thing, right? But I was Lars Lerup, who was the dean at Rice at the time. He kind of liked the fact that I was the crazy guy who was a math major and had his own computer at his desk, at his thing to do whatever I was going to do. So he kind of told Robert and Marianne that, oh, you have Chris Nichols and he's going to probably do stuff on computers and you guys should embrace this, right? And so they kind of did, and I did, and they were very cool about me doing stuff. And so I did everything in renderings. Like, I actually did my entire presentation for them with no drawings. Everything was renderings. Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of them. And then I decided to make a physical model as well.
Yeah.
And they said, why even bothering with a physical model? And I said, well, I have to do something while it's rendering. Because rendering took so long. It was like a Pentium 90 at the time, right? So rendering took so long that I said, I got to do something while it's – and they all laughed at me. So, yeah. But they were really cool. And I've always sort of had this thing about Sarek being a little bit different, a little unusual, mm-hmm. And a really – there's some very cool people. Actually, the guy who kind of runs our Baltimore office, Corey Rubidoux, he's a Sarek grad as well.
Yeah.
So, really cool. So, all right. So you went to you worked for Eric Owen Moss. Now I want to figure out, did you work on the Paramount Laundry Building?
I did not. That okay. was we started. His office was right next door in the Ince Building. I did the one on the corner. It was called Jem Fatale Collins.
Okay.
Where they took the corner out of the tilt-up building.
Right. Okay.
And then that was where we were my first time around. The second time around, he moved here right down the street from you.
Right.
And we did Stealth and The Box. And right. we did the Samatar building over. And
yep.
Down the street.
Did you do the building across from the Samatar building? Which, well, I forgot which number. Well, anyway, that's where I was. I was at Sway Studio, which okay. had an office over there.
Oh, at 8522.
Yes.
With that whole complex, yeah.
Yes. That's
so the box that floats above, I did that.
Yeah, okay. I was in that office. And the another office I was in that you designed was the ImageWorks.
Yeah.
So Sony ImageWorks, those long-ass corridors.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. That was you had been part of that, right?
Yeah, that was my first opportunity to lead the design on a project.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at a different firm. I'd left Eric's. I was at an interiors firm called ISI for about 3 years.
Okay.
It was run by Diane Hoskins.
Oh, Diane Hoskins. Okay.
And the designer on the project was doing it for ImageWorks, and it was a new group that was coming up. They were in an Ehrlich building at the time.
Right.
And they didn't like the designer that was on the project because he didn't get them.
Mm-hmm.
And I was young and I knew how to use digital tools and they right. kind of said, well, put him in front of them. And they did. And I hit it off and ended up designing that project from beginning to end. It was my first like soup to nuts project.
Nice.
And it was great. Tom Hershey was the client
yep.
over at Sony and you know, he was great to work with and they wanted to do, you know, everything, every crazy idea threw out there. They're like, yeah, that's going to work great. And, you know, this
well,
is
they
had
to right have a massive render farm, massive amount of computers at the time, right? Like, didn't they try to, like, turn it on and it shut down the block or something?
As a matter of fact, they did because they, you know, the computer room was large and it was like in the top 10 of the computing centers in the U.S.
Right.
For a short
at
period
the time,
of time.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, DWP is funny to work with because you tell them what your loads are and they go, yeah, we don't believe that here. You get this much transformers.
Right.
And so sure enough, the first time they turned it on, fired up everything with all the air conditioning going, they blew the transformers in the street.
Right.
And so they had to come back and replace them.
Right.
It was cool because I got to, you know, they let me design the computer room and everything.
Right.
There. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean, back, I remember you actually, when we were still at Gensler, you arranged for a tour of it with Tom Hershey, right?
Yeah.
And we were going down and there was, well, that's how old it was. It was filled with purple boxes.
Yeah, with indigo.
With those huge ass SDI machines, but those are all gone.
And they used to home run it. It's funny because they would.
Yeah. So, okay. So this is interesting. This is one of the first cases I've seen where all the workstations were in the. When the actual machine room,
yep.
and they would basically be KVM'd into people's desks,
right?
And so you wouldn't know which computer you would get. It didn't matter, and you would log in, et cetera. And that seemed very novel at that time.
Yep.
Interestingly, when I went to Sony years and years later, and I actually was an employee there, that had a computer at my desk.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, and they switched it out because I understood that they went back and home-runned it then – a few years later.
Yes, and they have. And in fact, a lot of people are doing that now. And the reason, there's several reasons they're doing it, mostly for security reasons.
Oh, really?
So mostly it's like calls from like Marvel or whoever you're working with to not let out whatever. So they
don't want
control.
A USB outlet.
Yeah, I know. It's a friend of mine. He's working over at, I don't know if I can say the name of the friend, but I'm going to pretend I'm not going to say it, but he's working at this company and basically he's at his desk in Santa Monica and his computer is in Burbank.
Yeah.
Right. And that's going to happen. I mean, that's the way cloud computing is going to work. And people are like, oh, cloud computers. I was like, it's already happening. It may not be Google's data center, but it's your own somewhere else.
We do a lot of that right now.
You do. You do, yeah, right?
Because I can't remember the name of the software, but we work on these really big projects and we have multiple offices. So I just finished the Cowboys headquarters and training facility in Frisco. And so it was a collaboration with us in Dallas. And so you're working on a Revit file. It has to be one Revit file. You know, they break it up into different pieces, but who's working on it doesn't really split along the same lines as how you do the model. So all the work we did is actually sitting up in San Francisco in Silicon Valley.
Right.
And we just log in and you're really running the Revit sessions out of San Francisco.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. That makes sense. So we should note that Diane Hoskins, who I guess was at the firm, what was the name of the firm again?
ISI.
She was part of ISI, and then she is now
the co-CEO
of Gensler.
That's right. She moved
because she was the head when I was in Houston. She was the head of the DC office.
That's right.
And Andy Cohen was the head of the LA office. Yeah, and now they're co-CEOs. Right?
That's right. They've been that way for a little over 10 years now.
Yeah. I love Gensler. I still do. I think it's an amazing company. It's so big now and so crazy. But it's really, really kind of interesting. But yeah. And then when we started that thing, obviously you went to Gensler. You said you'd only been there about a year. So did you go from there to Gensler?
Yeah, I had tried to get a job in the LA office.
Right.
And it never quite worked out well. And Diane was in the DC office. And she said, I want you out here. And so she paid for me and the family to move out to D.C. And we started working out there. And Jordan was there already at the time.
Right. So you had been there about a year. And then I came on board. I was working with Edward Fulce. Right?
Yep.
So he sort of introduced me to the group. And this is kind of one of the main things I want to talk to you about. Back then, it was an exciting time in CG.
Mm-hmm.
It was an exciting time in terms of innovation, an exciting time in terms of what computers can do. I mean, you were just talking about how at Eric Owen Moss's office, you introduced them to a computer.
Yeah.
Right. And then we also, just considering the fact of all these young guys who were getting together in this 3DM group, I think we called it the Digital Design Group later or something like
later
that.
Later we changed it.
Yeah, but it was called the 3DM Group, which was, I guess, was 3D and multimedia.
That's right.
Multimedia was still a thing back then. It's not a thing now.
You didn't know where it was going.
Yeah. But everyone was a little bit different. Mm-hmm. You know, all of those, you had people like Kyle, who was much more project management style guy. But still
he is now, yeah.
Yeah. And then you had you were definitely sort of, leadership position. And then you'd have someone like me and Mark Briggs who were like, let's try the craziest thing possible. And we all sort of talked about, how we're going to use these tools, how it's going to innovate design, what's happening with rendering. At the time we were – towards the end of my stay at Gensler, we were basically really pushing what global illumination was and how it's going to influence lighting for design and all of those things. And so I had left in around 2002 and I was wondering, when I came back into the Chaos Group, but like, well, so what's going on at the architecture firms? And it doesn't seem as passionate as we were? Do you think is it just because we were young?
part of it was we were young. It was also, for me personally, I always felt like every version of AutoCAD or 3D Studio or, any rendering technology, I had been waiting for that technology to come because the way I design projects, I wanted to design in 3D space. I wanted to see what the building was going to really look like with rendering technology. And I was as much as I like renderings, I was less concerned with making a beautiful, perfect rendering at the end.
Sure.
I was much more interested in just what is reality of what I'm trying to do and imagine in my head.
Right.
And so it always felt like when the technology came out, you had imagined all those tools ahead of time and they were finally showing up. And I think there was a point at which they caught up, you know, it was doing everything that I had ever hoped that it would do, mm-hmm. and didn't feel like I was anticipating the technology as much. And it was a bit ubiquitous.
Okay.
And now it's kind of part of everyday things that we do. The tough part has been that Revit has kind of jumped in. And, you know, doing architecture is hard enough as a design process,
sure.
you know, and learning all the tools to go along with and all the technology that goes along with building 3D models, it takes a dedication. And,
sure.
you know, even when you were there, you know, very few people could actually 3D model and do all of that work. And so now that we're doing all of the documentation in Revit, and to me, that takes up all that brain space of learning that technical tool, because it takes a long time to really become really proficient in Revit.
Okay.
And so I think people are really focused on, you know, designing and what they're doing as an architect, as well as the technical tool that is sitting in front of them is Revit. Mm-hmm. And becoming an expert in that is enough. And it just takes up all of the time you could spend doing all the other things. At least as far as
I don't want to sound like I'm going to bash Revit, but I know it's yours. But okay, so you're right. Revit is a huge brain suck, right? Mm-hmm. And before, back in my day, you know, I sat around at my desk, modeling things in Max or whatever. Maybe sometimes in AutoCAD. Mostly, I modeled in Max, but I had people that were sitting at their desk in AutoCAD, you know, doing drawings, 2D drawings mm-hmm. of stuff, picking up red lines, doing things like that, clocking it. And they were bored. They were very, very bored. Mm-hmm. It was a simple tool. AutoCAD was not that complicated to do. You know, it's a drafting table. It's like a digital drafting table. And they were not that excited, but I think the thing is, if Revit is so complicated to use and it takes them so much energy, then does that inhibit the design process?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Absolutely it does. And so I've been frustrated by the desire to push Revit into the design realm. Because for me, it is solely
appropriate. It's a project management
tool. Well, it's a documentation tool.
Okay.
And so once you've finished through an SD phase, a schematic design phase, and a concept design phase, then you should be picking up Revit and using that to do it. And, you know, like Autodesk does with every one of their tools, they want it to be all things for all people. And they have created a bunch of tools that are fairly good at doing conceptual design work with. And there are some things that are more efficient to do on some types of buildings if you start day one using Revit. Mm-hmm. But my own personal opinion is that it is inhibitive to a much greater creative process if you try to jump in too soon. And so I prefer to use any other more flexible generic tools like a Rhino or a SketchUp or, in my case, AutoCAD at those earlier phases, because I think you can get a lot more, you know, the value of abstraction is not as valued as it should be. Mm-hmm. And Revit is a very precise tool,
right.
And it's not as good at being generic about design ideas as I think it should be.
Okay. I mean, do people still do physical modeling as much as they used to?
So we do a lot more now than we ever did, because we never had the space for it.
Oh.
And so now we've got when we moved downtown in 2011, we built out about 1,500 square foot model shop. Mm-hmm. So it's got table saw and drill and 3D printers and laser cutters and all that stuff.
Nice.
And it was really nice, but it wasn't.
So do your designers actually go down there and build stuff, or do they basically say,
they do.
Yeah, they do.
They do. And some more than others. But part of it is, I mean, taking the elevator down isn't easy.
Okay.
So what they've done is they've built small maker shops inside of the regular space.
Okay.
So there's one up in the tower. There's another one up in the jewel box that we have. Mm-hmm. And then now we're about to build a bridge over to the other tower.
Right.
And they built out a much bigger, large model shop up there that's like immediately accessible to everybody. And they glass around it and you can see what's going on.
You know, it's interesting. I was over at at Herzog and de Meuron in Basel, they have a massive model shop. They have not only a massive model shop in their actual office, mm-hmm. but then they have another building that also does like full scale mockups.
And that's that's Frank's office as well,
right?
And when I was at Eric's, you walk in there, it's wall to wall models, mm-hmm. and that's how they work. And I'll say for me personally, I've never. I always felt like model making, physical model making, was so much slower than what I could do in 3D
right.
that I just never ended up doing it much.
So here's an interesting point that came up because it was something that has come up. I have been trying to dig at this architectural design problem, right? And you know, I hate to say it, I think I agree with you a little bit about the Revit problem, but I think that Revit's not going to go away, so we can't necessarily pretend. But I think it does inhibit the design process in its current state, the way people think about it. You can't sort of think of it that way. And I think that the rhinos and the SketchUps are good. But there's something about models that is really cool, right? But, and this is something that's come up, virtual reality is another really interesting thing because one thing the model can't give you is actual perceptual scale. Mm-hmm. You can put a little guy next to a door and you get the idea, right?
Yeah.
Here's an example, right? I had an internship over at Fox and Fowl Architects, right? And we were doing this. I was doing this design for this building. It was the American Bible Society, and we were doing their entrance. And so we made a sketch, a chipboard model that was about this big of the whole building. And then we did a smaller, more detailed piece of where we were going to enhance the entryway and put this new entrance in there. And they were designing number 4 Times Square at the time,
yeah.
the giant, very famous building that everyone knows with the round LED thing in front. So they were designing that building at the time, and it was this huge model. And then we were like, this massive model. And we realized, hey, what scale is your model? And we realized they were actually at the same scale.
Yeah.
And that our building could fit inside the lobby of their building. And we never realized that they were same scale, right? And so they realized, oh my God, this lobby is 10 stories tall or something crazy like that, right? And that's something a model can't always, you know, tell you that.
Yeah.
And so this is what I'm trying to get at is virtual reality, right? I think that virtual reality has a much more important role to play in architecture. And I think architecture needs to embrace it stronger than anyone else. If you go to any virtual reality conference out there right now, they're all talking about movie making and games.
Yeah.
No one's talking about architecture, which I think should be completely trumping all of those in terms of virtual reality.
I always think people overestimate how many architects there are and how much money they have to spend on it.
No.
To make it a big part of the industry.
Okay. Yes, architects are definitely cheap. Some of the cheapest people out there by far. But there's a ton of them, way more than people think. I know this because I work for Chaos Group, and I know how many more customers we have in this than people think that VFX is huge, and it's not, right? Mm. I mean, my guess is if you took all the people working on visual effects for major films or around the world, right, it's probably about 10,000, 12,000 total amount of people in all the big companies, right? So you take the top 15 big VFX companies, we're about 10,000, 12,000. Trust me, there's like just ArcViz is probably close to 500,000.
Okay, yeah.
So it's much bigger. And then architecture is even bigger than that. So I think that, yes, no, it is a smaller profession. Yes, there are much more lawyers than there are architects out there.
I always think about it compared to, you compared it to gaming. and the amount of money in gaming and the number of people are, you know, in that virtual environment just seems so much bigger than.
Well, the number of much money, yes. Well, architects are the typical problem of a creative service department, right?
Yeah.
Because creative services is always going to be like very passionate about stuff and then totally undercut the value of what they're actually
doing.
That's
right. Because they always pit us against each other, you know. Don't you want this job?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's the same thing in VFX.
So I, you know, for me personally, the use of VR in architecture actually has a much more relevant application to architects themselves than it does for presentations and for
I think it has both, and they're different.
I think they're different, and I think because look, an architect spends 40 hours a week working on the design, and in theory, he could be in that space the entire time working on the design.
Sure.
And he might get half an hour with a client to walk him through a few key things.
Right.
And so, and because, and you know this because you've been in the field, all of the effort and all of the things that you have to consider to make a building or a space, it's not just about how it feels in that space. It's a whole slew of decisions about structure and mechanical and light
functionality. Program.
Yeah, all of those things come in and cost. And so you can't convey all of that stuff to your client in that you still got that only that half hour to convey all of those things to them.
Yep.
And so the things that I've done with with rendering or 3D or 2D tools, it's all about how to convey the things that are most important to that client at that time. And so a small snippet of that is, how does it look and how does it feel to be in that space? And so that's where, kind of as I was mentioning before about abstraction, being able to abstract ideas and tell a story in just bite-sized pieces that a client can understand is something that VR doesn't do very well, because there's so much, they can look at anything and everything at the same time.
Okay. So you said one of the very key things that I think is important, and that you're going to be right on the same page as me. You're telling a story, right? Architects are storytellers. You design a process. I mean, this is what we learned in school, right? Mm-hmm. We go in front of a jury and you present your project. You have to literally perform it for them, right? It's almost like acting, right? And you could have a really beautiful drawings and really nice design, but if you don't present it well, you're going to get slaughtered, right? So presenting and selling the design is a huge part of it, which is a type of narrative. It's a non-linear narrative.
Right.
And it's very good at doing that. The problem with VR right now is that people are trying to insert the typical script-driven linear third-person narrative and putting it into a VR experience.
Right.
And that, I think, is what's wrong. And that's why I think the architect can actually come in and reintroduce the idea of the architectural narrative in VR, because I think that's the thing that VR is missing. It's a first-person experience. Architects present first-person experiences to people. And you do that. You just describe that. And no, you're right. It's not all about the visuals. It's about how do you use the space and what is it going to do in the garage situation and the this and the this, you know, everything. There's so much to be told.
Well, and you've seen Bjark Engels present projects, and he's probably the most talented person at doing that now, selling designs to clients and to the public and telling a story about how the building came to be and how he created the space. And I haven't seen him do a great deal of work in VR, but he uses technology to tell those stories in a way that is way out ahead of most people out there.
Sure.
And so I think there is a place for VR, but it doesn't, it's hasn't felt to me like it's a required piece of the storytelling that we're doing. I think that standing in a space and seeing a single point of view can be overwhelming. And you want to be able to direct the attention of the people that you're telling that story to and point them to things that are, you know, the point you're trying to get across. I think the trouble with that, and it's like a lot of the walkthroughs you do is like, okay, here's my design, and you hand it over to this other technology and this other presentation technique that you don't have control over, it's really hard to control the narrative after you've done that. It's the reason that, we did some animations early on when we were doing 3D work for design, and boy, there's nothing that stops a presentation like handing over and saying, okay, now I'm going to run the video, because it always feels like you've lost the audience, unless it melded perfectly in the narrative that you were going along with and that the audience was with you the entire time.
Well, we were new to this, right? And so back, I remember when you and I were doing this some 18 years ago, we did the worst thing possible, which is I actually didn't do it. So the first thing I stopped doing was getting a path and running the camera along the path, right? And doing the walkthrough where it's a, 2,000 frame animation of walking through an architectural space. I said, and I use this argument, I was teaching it right at the time. I use this argument why you should never do that. It's like, if you ever watch a movie, the only time the camera moves forwards is if you're being chased by a monster in a horror film, right? So you never do that. So, but I think there are some beautiful ways of illustrating architecture through animation. Yep. And you're right. What it should be is click the video and then you keep talking.
Yes, exactly.
Right? Like a TED talk.
Yeah. And the shorter the clips are, the better, because you never know how a presentation is going to go. You never know how you want to be able to see the look in your client's eyes when you're showing them anything.
Right.
And if there's the least hint of trouble about something and you see that, you want to stop and explain or ask and be able to go and divert in a different direction.
Yeah. I remember, it was interesting. It was a long, 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 long time ago, but I was doing a presentation, and I was on about iRobot, I think. I did a presentation about iRobot. And it was in Spain, and one of the guys who was presenting with me, they did the four of us together, and we sort of had us all sort of go back to back. And Dan Lemon was the last one, and he did a presentation about Lord of the Rings. And I was like, oh boy. And so he had just like hours of footage of Lord of the Rings. Yeah. And so he just played it. Like, just played the whole thing of just, I can't. And he was like, oh yeah, and on this one we did this and this. Like, there was no like, I'm going to show you a short clip of this one thing that we did, and then I'm going to talk to you about it. And then we're like, no, it was just like playing and playing and playing. And the audience was like, oh my God, they were just so
can't catch their breath.
Couldn't catch their breath. Yeah. Right. And I think that's the way it can be. It was interesting. I took a little, after I left Gensler, I was completely into the visual effects world. I never really sort of looked back at the architecture field much until Jeff Model came back to me, and he wanted me to present over a thing. And so that's when I started catching up. That's actually when I met Lon for the first time. And I saw ArcViz. Like, ArcViz had blossomed out of architecture, right? Mm-hmm. And then they were doing shit with green screens and full-on presentations with helicopter shoots, and just like, whoa, what happened to architectural visualizations? Like, this is a whole new thing. And I think one of the things that really became like pinnacle moment where people, even in the arc, was when the what's his name, Alex Roman's piece that he did on the which was not the Louis Kahn building. Yes, it was a Louis Kahn building. It was the library, Exeter Library.
In lights, it wasn't Exeter, but it was done in Lightscape, right?
No, it was done in V-Ray.
Okay,
but it was not. It was in the 2000s. But he did a video about it, and it was like amazingly well cinematography done video, and it sort of like redefined what architectural visualization can be. And ever since that video came out, all the ArcViz guys are doing the same thing. Like, they're all like, and that's fine. It's good. It's like, that's the turning point, and now everything looks much better. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a cinematic experience. It's a nonlinear cinematic experience, which I think is really cool. I think it's a way of telling a story that was really cool as well. Mm-hmm. It's much more, since it's all visual, it's much more symbolic and interpretive as opposed to you telling a story. But I don't know. There's something that's going on that's in technology that can bring back the passion of a good presentation and make really beautiful things happen. And I think virtual reality is, I know what you mean, but I think it's important.
I'll tell you, there's there are different processes that we go through as architects, depending upon the situation. So there are times when you're doing a competition, mm-hmm. right? And the people you're presenting it to, you're going to present them a finished product that they have never seen before. And you have an opportunity to tell an entire story. And that can be a completely immersive environment because you get the time to put that whole narrative together. But the vast majority of projects that we do these days, we've started with a plan, an idea, and you've met with a client every single week. Mm-hmm. And they've seen that thing grow all the whole time. And so there's a whole bunch of projects that I do that we never do any finished renderings because we've taking them all the way through the whole process.
So they already know what it's going to look like.
They know what it's going to look like.
Right.
And every rendering you show them, even if it's not a, even though they're not beautiful renderings, they're just representative of what you're doing and how this, how you're solving problems. They're totally bought into it. And at the end of the day, if you show them a rendering of the thing in the end, like, oh, yeah, I know that's what it looks like because I've had it in my head now for a year because right. we built it up.
Yeah, it's true. And I think that, like at that point, right, that's where those archivist companies flourished because you guys would outsource that for mm-hmm. marketing or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. It's a real estate firm and they want to be able to sell right. space or whatever, right?
It's when you're trying to introduce that project to people who've never seen it before.
Right.
And you need to be able to, and you may not even be in the room. So it goes out to the public, you know, things for public review, that it needs to be able to stand alone and tell the whole story without you being in the room. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we do, and we farm so much of that out to other archivist companies.
Right.
And
it's interesting. It was so just a quick question to clarify. It wasn't long ago when we introduced the fact that we're going to do V-Ray for Revit, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which I think, I mean, overall, it's going to be a valuable tool for you guys, right?
Yeah.
But just to help people that are archivist people that are listening to this, that is not going to take away from archivist companies' work,
no.
is it? It has nothing
no, absolutely
to do with
not.
It has nothing to do with it, right?
That's right. Because representing it realistically is not the same thing as representing it beautifully.
Right.
And in its best light, which is what, you know, at the end of the day, that's why you're hiring an outside company. They're going to bring in, you know, and take the time to do all the entourage and set the cameras and the lighting, that way that they have spent their entire careers
sure.
perfecting that artistry.
Mm-hmm.
And architects are spending their careers perfecting the artistry of the architecture. And the two, you know, there's certainly a time that that was all, you know, just part of all the things that architects do. But because you've got so much specialization with these archivist companies and they can invest in technology and training themselves to do those things, that, like I said, there's not all that headspace to hold all those things in single individuals. Even in a firm, you would divide those up
right.
amongst multiple people sometimes.
So. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was definitely one of those guys that was categorized as, oh, this guy's got all the brain power to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I was that. I mean, I think I remember being to Nyla Leiswitz, right?
Yep.
She's in
Chicago.
Chicago now. She was great. I loved her. Anyway, I was the one when I went up to her and I said, you know, I went to Rice. I was a good designer at Rice. Why can't I be on a design team? And mm-hmm. she goes, listen, Chris, we can find a designer. We can't necessarily find someone who can do the renderings
yeah.
like you do. And
that's
it's right. like, it's like, okay, I that's fair. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, we don't doubt that you're a good designer. So, but you know, she did give me some opportunities, but, anyway, so there's a couple dilemmas we have.
Mm-hmm.
Architects are cheap.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
They're cheap because they have to be because they're lean, right?
Right?
They have to run lean because of the way things go. It's not necessarily. They also resistant to technology. They've always traditionally been resistant towards technology in some ways. I mean, it's not like they're like, oh, we got to get the latest and greatest because they're cheap also.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, technology is not embraced. It's usually in a large firm like Gensler, you're going to have a good group of people that are going to be excited about technology. But the vast majority of people are not necessarily, that's not their focus, right?
That's right. They're focused on the design and the architecture.
The design and the architecture.
Yeah.
So that's the next thing, right? What are they focused on? What's the part that gets them out of bed every day? in terms of design and the architecture, when they go to work, is it like getting down and getting dirty with the model? Is it meeting with the clients? Mm-hmm. Is it what is that design itch that's getting satisfied? And how the what I'm trying to get at is like, instead of just introducing technology and using it, it's like, look at this cool tool like VR or whatever, because that's the problem, right? You can't just say, VR is cool. Let's do something in VR because that's what people are doing now.
That's right.
Let's actually figure out what we need to do and say maybe VR can help solve that or enhance that or make that a better experience.
Yeah, for me, the thing that I would look forward to is a VR interface.
Interface.
For doing design work, yeah.
So you're actually designing in VR.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. Because, you know, you're looking at a screen, and I probably got the biggest screen in the whole firm. I got, sitting on my desk, and I got a couple of them, and it's not enough real estate because it, and you can't see things in 3D all the time. And to be able to see it stereoscopically and have all the tools available to you that you have on your desktop in a VR environment where, you know, you've got 180 degrees, you know, practically, that you can turn your head and be able to live in it, just like you're living in a real space. And that could be, you know, it's VR or AR, which I think is probably the real ultimate goal, so that you're not completely in a blind environment relative to what's really around you. But for me, that would lead naturally into better presentation techniques for meeting with clients and talking to them about that. And, you know, multimodal as well, where you've got multiple people in the same environment looking at the same things.
It seems to be that's a common theme, right? So with architecture, the problem is when you're presenting something, you can only present it at one person at a time, right?
Yeah.
And I see that when I go to any VR conference, which there's like one every 3 days, I think. The problem is it's single person experience, one after the other. Yet. So every booth or whatever has like a long line because only one person can see this at a time.
But I don't understand. Why is that?
Why is that what?
Why is it that only one person can see it at one time? You can load the same model onto multiple.
You can. You can have multiple headsets, but okay, let's just put it this way. You go to let's go to the 2000s, whatever. Let's go to 2000 in New Orleans. Remember that one?
Yep.
You get a booth, 25, 30 people are there looking at your presentation. Do you really want to get 35 headsets going?
well, no, but you know, your typical presentation to a client or a room full of people is 5 people.
So. Yeah, you can. And there's ways of working around that. And there's definitely solutions that are coming. You have to realize that VR is still very much at its infancy.
Sure.
And I think they're chasing around the wrong thing. They're going after the single story thing. And I don't know. It's just my opinion. I know, but I'm really adamant about it because I think architects can solve the VR problem in many ways. One, they can use it for like literally practically right now, right? It makes sense to use it.
Sure.
Just for design process, just like you said, or even just for like, did I design that right? Put on the headset. It's like, oh no, that windowsill is way too low or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
Just those things where you can do some design process and understand it. And that's what they're talking about at Herzog when they like introduced the old fogey designers. Now I wouldn't say old fogey because they're not that old fogey, but they're – and they put a headset on. It's like, all right, let me try this thing. And they're like, oh, this is weird. It was like, and then within like less than 30 seconds, they're making design decisions they didn't even realize that they were doing.
Sure.
They're like, oh, is that really where that window is? Mm. Oh, wait, you know what? And they were just – suddenly it went on is like, do you realize that you just changed the design because of what you experienced here? You may not have done that if you didn't have this.
Well, we saw that in the early days when we were doing 3D designs because you'd have designers were sitting over your shoulder and you'd show them the rendering of it. They show them the 3D space. They go, well, that's not what it is. Like, nope, that's what you drew.
Exactly.
That's what you told us to do. So
yeah, and or does you know reception desks were too high or too low or, and then the other thing that I think is critical is the fact that right now you go into the VR world and it's all designed by people with computer science backgrounds or that are doing stuff and they don't really think about design. And I think the biggest thing that's missing from the virtual world in the VR is good architecture. And I think architects should play a role in this, not concept designers. I think architects, people that understand space and program and the experience and moving around. I mean, I would, if I were, like, I would love to have, you know, God let her rest in peace, but a Zaha Hadid virtual reality experience would have been amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, in fact, it'd probably be better in virtual reality than in reality.
Well, it's funny. So in this world where we have environments and they're designed by architects, who is spending their time in there? Because the application
for architects. No one, because it's freaking ugly.
Okay, but once it's beautiful, who spends their time in there and doing – what are they doing?
Well, that's the thing, right? What are they doing in your building to start with?
Well, they're doing work and they're sitting down and focused. And so the interface that's
– Well, okay, but come on. You still travel to go see great architecture. You still go to the Parthenon. You still go to the Pantheon. You mm-hmm. still go to wherever, right? And you go look at architecture. You go look at the Eiffel Tower, right?
Yeah. And so I guess it goes back to the question is you're creating an AR space. Is it – then is it for entertainment value? Is it to be environment around
I'm saying
you?
I'm saying that if you're going to look at the entertainment part of the VR experience or the leisurely one, let's call it the entertainment one, wouldn't it be awesome if it was a really well-designed space?
Sure.
And don't you think that architects should embrace that and realize that there's a new real estate space that's completely virtual that they can be a part of?
I think it can be. I think
if they want to taste after that game money that you kept talking about, why don't they just go after that?
Well, I'll say this. So the actual architectural spaces adapt to their uses, and they are designed in a beautiful way that's perfectly adapted to how that space is going to be used. And so if you're going to spend 8 hours a day, for example, in an environment that is now going to be virtual, I think that architects aren't necessarily trained to design a space that is the perfect environment to get that job done as well, or at least, and I'm going to say they're not trained in it because it hasn't become an option, right? I think they may have the best training to become that, but it's a brand new field. It's a combination of, you know, user interface, computer user interface,
right,
and a physical three-dimensional space.
Right.
And so there is a future there, but I don't think it's even begun to be mapped out, because when I talk about working in a virtual space to design three-dimensional buildings, it's, you know, the building isn't just always at full scale for me. It's at half scale. It's a quarter scale. Same thing that we're doing details at. Mm-hmm. And so what is the space that I'm designing that building in? I don't know that it's necessarily a beautiful building with light coming in the corner, right?
It
might look like the world's best, user interface, like it's a software interface.
Right.
I think architects, because they understand three-dimensional space, may be people that have a great deal to contribute to that, but they're probably not the only people that are helping to make that space the best it can be.
Hmm. I don't know. I think, I definitely see your point. I still think that there's some contributions that need to be happening. I think there's more opportunities that architects may not necessarily realize they have. And I would love great architects to be part of it more directly, because the people who are doing it right now are people who used to be architects and left and went to the game industry and became, concept designers, right? And I think that there's ways that would be nice for the architects to actually do it for real, or not for real.
You have to. I am a naturally pessimistic person, and
that's fine. That's exactly okay. My wife and I always argue about this, and I'm cool with it. I am definitely the most positive person thing. I'm thinking about this is going
to
be
awesome. And I've listened to many of your podcasts, and I'm not sure I've heard one that doesn't talk about VR.
No, because it's but it's definitely and being pessimistic is another word that my wife likes to use, is called realistic. But you're right to have doubts, and I do too. I have lots of doubts. In fact, my doubts are the fact that I think that the VR focus is wrong, and
And I don't disagree with you on that at all.
Right.
I think that we don't understand the beginning of how VR and AR are going to be used in our everyday work life.
Sure.
In the future, and I think that Pokemon Go is a really interesting model
yeah.
for how AR is going to be all not right. just while you're sitting down focused, I'm going to put the headset on, that is the path to us simply having it on all the time.
Right. Yeah, I well, first of all, the current implementation of Pokemon Go is not really AR. It's GPS driven, right?
Okay.
So, but it does bring up the point that there's a fictional 3D world inside, parallel world, right?
Right.
And trust me, I play a lot of Pokemon Go because my son is – that's all he talks about. He was sick in bed the other day, and so I sat with him while he went to sleep. He's seven, or he's going to be seven. And he was dreaming and yelled out my name, and I thought he was sick. You know, I was going to, and he said, Daddy, Daddy. And he's, and then I was like, oh, it's like, I think we can evolve our Kanan. You think he was dreaming about Pokemon Go.
Of course.
But he was just, that is his thing, right? Minute we start walking around outside, he wants to play Pokemon. But he wants to walk outside, which is a great thing.
The most realistic vision of it that I've seen is you've seen hyperreality,
mm-hmm.
the little video. To me, that is so dead on to where we're all headed with this.
Yeah. We had I don't know if you listened to the Sally Slade podcast. Mm-hmm. She's great, but she's been developing a bunch of stuff with HoloLens, right?
Okay.
And she's really cool. And so she was showing me the crazy stuff she does because she's the best combination of really creative and really technical. Like, so she has a really creative idea and she can execute it technically, right? So she's also very cool and fun, right? Mm-hmm. So, I don't want to say childish, but she has a childlike mind in the sense of creativity.
Sure.
So she made a game as part of a hackathon called The Floor is Lava.
Okay.
Where it's an AR experience and you have to stand on the furniture because the floor is lava. And you have to jump from furniture to furniture where there's like popsicles to cool you off.
Sure.
Right? And so it's the total AR experience of pretending the floor is lava, except you actually look down and the floor actually looks like lava.
Right.
And that's a great idea, you know, and sort of like transforming the world that you have into augmenting it or mixing it or whatever. And I don't know. That's really cool. I don't know. There's something that's going to happen that's going to change. And I think that right now people are really scared of it. The way that people were just basically bashing Pokemon Go because they didn't understand why people were using it is just an example of people not understanding a new technology yet.
Yeah. The nostalgia half of that was pretty funny. My son is 26.
Yes.
And we went to a family outing and he and all the other cousins that were younger are like, oh, see you later. There's a something over on the around the corner. And they all just went off, you know, around the streets.
To pack catch Pokemon.
To go catch Pokemon, yeah.
Right.
And the worst, there was when we went down to the Santa Monica Pier and it was just like, it's like, oh my God, you have no idea how many things are down here at the pier.
Yeah, I heard about the Santa Monica Pier.
Yeah.
I heard about it. And the other thing that was funny, okay, so I went to Trojan Horse was a unicorn conference, right?
Which you'll have to explain the name.
Okay, I'll explain it. We're going to go for drinks after this. Everyone on the podcast has heard it a million times.
Okay.
But anyway, I was in Portugal, right?
Yeah.
And so Brady, my son, says, well, you're going to go to another country, right? And I said, yeah. And he goes, well, you have to play Pokemon Go because they have different Pokemon down there.
Yeah.
And it's all geographically based. And I was like, you know, we're paying more. So I said, okay. So I went down to, you know, and I'm looking around for Pokemon. And I found a couple. And I was sending pictures like, oh, look, I caught this new guy and whatever. And so anyway, I was having drinks with a couple of the attendees over there. And one of the guys said, and turns out another guy was in the same boat as me. Like, he actually really likes Pokemon Go because he plays with his son, mm-hmm. right? Same as me. And he goes, oh, I was in Lisbon. I was near. And look at this. And he says, Mr. Mime. I've got a Mr. Mime. I was like, what the hell is Mr. Mime? It's like, only available in Europe. Only in Europe. And he was so excited. And I was like, what? And then we got very excited. And then all of a sudden, all of us is like, no, it's like, there's all these people that took over the you know, which team are we on? The red team. It's like, let's go over and take over all the gyms in the resorts. Mm-hmm. Like, let's do that. Yeah. So I don't know. It's kind of fun. It's kind of fun. But again, that's a spatial experience too, right?
Sure.
And technology taking advantage of spatial experiences. And I think that VR and AR are definitely going to be part of the architectural experience. What about an architectural experience where you design just a box and then everything inside it changes?
You know, we talked about that a little bit a couple of years ago when, you know, the size of video screens have gotten so large. And if you look at any of the projects going to go down on Figueroa, you know, almost 50% of that facade is video screens.
Yeah.
And so all of the architecture is now in those screens in the interface. And so the content developers for that are becoming the people that are
the architects.
Are the architects.
Yeah.
And we've got a group in Gensler that's a little scattered. There's pockets of it in San Francisco and New York. We're very good at doing that content creation.
Oh, for video screen stuff, right?
Yeah.
Because there was a video screen around – it was like an elevator lobby, right?
Yeah.
And then it
it's
video
the
screen
and all the water.
All the water coming down. Basically, looks like you're about to go into a waterfall to go into the elevator.
And the Cosmopolitan, when it came out and all the columns were covered with that.
Right.
You know, was the first time I'd really seen, you know, look, it's just part of everything you're doing here.
Right.
But we've talked about that a number of times that, you know, what if the whole building is just, it's a blank facade and all it is video and you're changing that out every day. And and the design of that. What happens on that face?
Or make it an augmented reality thing where you can everyone has their own vision of what that is.
Which is, you know, a big part of what that hyper reality video was. Is,
right.
You know, and it's totally customized for every person that's walking through there. It looks different for every person that is there. I think the design of that that's a space for architects in the future as well.
It was funny because like Sally was talking about the same thing on her personal level, not on the architecture side, but she was saying, you know, because she does a lot of cosplay stuff, right? And she was saying, you know, I'd like to be able to continue to do cosplay, but it's not socially acceptable to go to work as a unicorn.
Right.
what if we all had VR and I'd allow certain people that I know would be cool with me being a unicorn to look at me as a unicorn.
But of course, you know, what if it's not your headset that they're wearing, right? And so what if they're just putting on the face that they would like to see you look like every day? So
yes. Yeah, it's true. It's true. But I don't know. You're right. There's something that's very disengaging with virtual reality and something very engaging with augmented reality. I don't necessarily think that architects are going to stop building physical things.
No.
But I think that they should be part of the virtual and augmented world as well. You know, just like you said,
We might stop building it if you get your real-time renderers, you know, perfectly, you know.
Yeah. I mean, that's going to happen one way or another. And that's just a matter of getting the computational power to work.
Yeah.
So what are the things that you're looking forward to? Not having so much email?
Certainly. Technology-wise, you know, like I said, an interface that I can be completely immersed in, you know, what it is that we're designing, and not have that distance that we have right now.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond
tilt depression.
And you know, the things that I'm focused on are really just about manufacturing or about computational design things.
Okay.
Those are Grasshopper and Plug-in the Rhino that we've got a group of people that are working on.
Yeah.
That's really exciting things just in the creation of design and not necessarily the visualization of it.
Yeah. I mean, we've actually got a early version, definitely not for the public yet, of V-Ray running with Grasshopper. Hmm. Because the prior problem is that you have to kind of de-grasshopperfy your stuff before you render it in Rhino.
Right.
And now you can just render it natively with Grasshopper.
Wow.
And Grasshopper is really cool. It's parametric design process, right? Do you remember back when I was in, I guess you're definitely older than me, but not that far. But so I guess when I was in architecture school, which was between 93 and 97, there was a guy named Greg Lynn. Do you remember him?
Yeah. He's still at UCLA.
Oh, he is?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. He did, like, he was like, I'm going to show you this new design thing called NURBS, right? Yep. It was like, whoa, crazy shapes with curves, right? And it was also one of those architects, he designed things that could never be built.
Yeah.
Right? And so everyone sort of poo-pooed him for doing that in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of non-building architects.
We collaborated with Greg on a project about 6 years ago on a competition.
But I think that the concept of parametric design is an interesting one. That was actually my thesis at Rice was a concept of parametric. It was all designed with metaballs.
Yeah.
So it was weird. But I think that, Grasshopper is – the problem is I have now, it's – you look at a building and you can say that was designed in SketchUp.
Yeah.
That was designed in Revit. And then I look at these new cool things. They're like, whoa. It's like, that looks like it was done in Grasshopper.
Yeah. Well, we've done a number of projects where it's built up. And the great thing about Grasshopper is it's completely customized, right? So you're not having to pull things off of the shelf and then build your building with that. And so, every piece of architecture that's ever been made has some sort of series of dependencies and, if I make this hall bigger, then I've got to make that other thing smaller. And so if you can build that into how the structure works and customize it for what your priorities are each time, then you're not kind of reinventing the wheel every time you have to move a wall over.
Right.
So,
I like it. I like it. I like the idea of it. I think it's good. I think definitely, that was – it was if you think back to what you were talking about, your first at the beginning of the podcast with Erica and Moss, where you're like, oh, if I just build it in 3D, then I can get that critical dimension. Now everything is built in 3D, right?
Yeah.
Everything is all BIM'd out, right? Be it Revit or whatever you're using, so you're constantly never have to worry about getting that critical dimension.
Yeah,
That's both, I guess, a blessing and a curse. I don't know. I mean, do you see any value to still designing in 2D?
As an interesting exercise, sure. I mean, certainly all the planning work that we do, and we exist in a 2D world when we, because we still walk on flat surfaces for the most part.
Sure.
And so there's two-dimensional organization of buildings.
It hurts your ankles.
You always have problems with ADA. Trying to get anything to work on a slope.
Unless you're working on a skate park.
That's right. There's plenty of things that we do in 2D because that's how we live our lives.
Right.
Going up and down stairs is a choice that we make to get to a different level. So there's plenty of that that's necessary for what we do.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. And I think that a lot comes out of a napkin sketch as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there's still people who take out some vellum and just start drawing, which is nice. But I don't know. I am trying hard to find, and I'm not trying to push for anything. I'm using VR because it's the easiest thing for me to do. But I'm trying desperately to find something that technology can do. Like, if I was at Gensler right now, I'd be very frustrated as far as the me of 1999 or whatever. Not because I'd be like, come on, guys, look at all this cool stuff. Let's do something. Like, nah, we've already solved everything
it's
we need to solve.
It's a big ship.
No, I know, but I'm using Gensler as an example. I'm saying actually a lot of architecture firms seem that way. Yes, you're a very, realistic person, but I think that there's got to be something that technology can do that can really help solve some problems. And I think you guys definitely have some good guys. I know Scott DeWitty is a really cool guy that's looking at stuff. Interestingly, he's not an architect, right?
Yeah.
but I think that there's definitely some interesting things that can go on in this world. And I'm trying to find a hook. I'm trying to find a thing that I can get an architect to go, yeah, yeah, I want to invest time in my company or whatever to work with you guys on developing that and working on that and doing stuff. Because I'm VFX guys, they do that all day long, right? They reinvent the wheel every time, right? They just like every movie they can, we have to do something that's never been done before. Yep. So we have to do, you need technology to solve that problem. And architecture, they want to have that same problem and it doesn't seem to be that way.
Well,
it's definitely a slower ship, like you said.
Yeah, but I think there are a whole slew of things that just haven't been, you know, we've had ideas about solving them, and they're not even close to being solved in a thorough way like fabrication. And, you know, the things that are being done with, you know, CNC machines and robotics about how to take an idea that's on a computer and actually get it built in an automated way. And so those are things that we're 20 years from getting perfectly solved, and there's plenty of headway being made on it, and I think that there's a lot of people who are very passionate about it. And
so Lisa, you think construction is something that's going to be?
I think it absolutely is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Prefabrication. We did, I believe it was the Biennale, we did a 3D printed house in
yes.
Dubai.
Yes. Yeah. Jorge talked about that.
Yeah, out of our Costa Rica office. So
right.
Richard Hammond is down there.
A 3D printed house. Like, that's really awesome. So 3D printing concrete, is that what?
You know, this is one of those things. You know, Gensler's so large. You know, you hear about things and you say, yeah, we did that. And you're like, tell me the whole story. I didn't get to read the whole article. And so I know that we did it, and I know that it was very groundbreaking. Uh-huh. But you know, I have seen so many different, you know, versions of a 3D printed house that were, you know, just from a large scale, you know, five axis arm that's got a concrete nozzle at the end of it, you know, spraying on. And the guys in our office who did, and Tam, who's next door now at BNIM, he and Jared in our office did a drone controlled 3D printer.
Drone controlled 3D printer?
Yeah. So they basically got the nozzle for 3D printer attached to a drone, and then GPS ran the thing, and they got as far as a proof of concept on it. But it was right. Like, okay, I could see that actually working and, you know, moving around, and you do the big scale stuff here. And then at the small scale, it's got some control that, someday you can actually build things with that. So, I think there's a lot of future in those pieces, that has not even begun to be really realized.
Yeah. You know, something that almost disappointed me because I haven't really heard much about it since, and I thought it was brilliant, is the WikiHouse project. Do you ever hear about that?
I don't know that. Yeah.
It's a guy, he made, it's an open source house design thing, which is literally, it's a construction method of just a CNC cut plywood.
Okay.
With no nails required to assemble it. It's basically a jigsaw puzzle.
Uh-huh.
And you design these houses, or what they have houses that are designed, and then they're all the stuff are open sourced, and you just open them up in Revit. You make it, design it, do whatever you need to do, and then you submit it to be fabricated. Mm-hmm. And you just pay for it to be cut. All the cut pieces come to your thing.
Flat pack to your house.
Flat pack, and you assemble it.
That's great.
Right? And it's supposed to be this thing. It's like, oh, it's cheaper to build it that way, and you don't have any tools and stuff like that. And we actually, one of the guys in our office in Baltimore who's a big Revit guy, Ted, he used it to design our booth for the AIA conference.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did, and everyone coming by is like, what is this crazy, beautiful design? And they thought we were a design thing. It's like, oh, yeah. No, we're a rendering company. Like, oh, okay. And then we got them hooked with this booth. The booth was so cool that they came over to check out this cool booth, and they thought it was a part of a construction system.
Oh, that's great.
But yeah, I think I don't know. I think rapid prototyping is also has social implications to it, right? Because you technically, if you have the tools, you can build it.
Yep.
you know, you just need the, you know, the MakerBot or the drone, or in this case was a laser, someone who just has access to a router or whatever to make it work. So I don't know. I think that there's some social implications to rapid prototyping as well, or CNC or whatever.
It's a democratization of all the tools that used to be only a handful of people that had access to. So we're doing, we're actually doing new makerspaces for the LA Public Library. We're doing.
So what does that mean?
So that means that they're going to have laser cutters and 3D printers in the library. And you're also going to have design stations, and you'll have kind of a lot of different tools that, you know, normally you'd have to have a lot of money to buy that piece of equipment, and then you'd have to learn how to use it. So the the library will actually have that equipment there. People know how to use it, and you can go in there and learn how to use the tools and actually get your hands on it. So the full Adobe Suite and 3D Studio and all of those things will be there. They have green screens, they got cameras, mixing, sound mixing, all of those things for people to come in and use them. So, but there's a, you know, that whole maker movement with TechSpace, we're teaming up with them as well. I think it's going to be more in people's hands. It's a little bit of a, you know, a flashback to more vocational educations about how to use tools like that. But I think that's certainly coming. I think that's where, you know, the economy actually needs to get to as well.
It's interesting because I think that, you know, as we look at the hype curve, right, that everyone talks about, VR is still at the top of its hype curve right now. And 3D printing has kind of crashed a little bit, right? It doesn't necessarily mean it's not valid. It just means that people expected all kinds of different things out of it, I think, you know. When people started 3D printing guns, it was a little bit
disconcerting. We've got more 3D printers in the office than we've ever had.
How many do you have in your LA office?
In our LA office, we might have 8.
Right.
You know, at all different scales. And they kind of
remember when you got your first one in Santa Monica. Mark Briggs was running that one, right?
Yeah. You know, it was we were talking about it this morning. It was a huge investment, and, you know, the number of useful models that came out of it in the first year were, you know, very tiny amount, because you didn't know how to build models that would work, that would come out of it right, and, you know, and soaking in the bath and how long it'd take to go, and you'd have glitches in it, and, you know, so, but it was a way to get in and start to use it and create things. And so it's become a really useful tool to be able to work in a digital environment, use a model that you're doing to do renderings and as part of your normal process. And, oh, by the way, if I just give a little bit of advance notice, I actually get a physical version of that. And so, you know, as you probably know as well, that, you know, when you're sitting in a room with a client, the physical thing in the room always trumps anything printed on the wall and anything that's up on a screen. And so, you know, for us to be able to have that dialogue with a client and have a 3D model is always better.
Touch is a very important design language, right? Touching it, even if it's small or whatever, right? Yeah, I know. And when I was joking about making that model, because I had to do something while the renderings were going, part of me was also because I wanted to see what it looked like. The renderings don't always convey what it looks like, you know? And seeing the model actually helped me a lot. What was really crazy, I remember at the time, is I had designed it both in AutoCAD and in 3D Studio and done the renderings so many times that I actually built the model with no drawings. I just knew all the dimensions.
It's funny how you get.
I had no drawings. I can just start cutting. I know exactly how high that wall is.
And you get in the room with other people who just, you know, it's their first time seeing it, and you're walking them through, and it's like, okay, it's exactly over here, and I can just draw it for you right on the table. And they're like, wow, how did you do that? Sorry, I've lived this thing for 6 months.
No, I know exactly. You really know it inside and out, which I think is a beautiful thing, actually. You know, when that's in your mind like that. All right, so. We're definitely long, which is fine.
Sorry.
No, that's cool. So what I want to do is we're gonna go ahead and let the last bucket drop, and I'm gonna show you some stuff.
By the way, I keep every time you say that, I keep thinking, you know, he needs a sound effect of a bucket.
I do.
Do you have one?
Do you listen to the podcast?
I do.
I drop a bucket at the end. Don't hear the ka-dunk, ka-dunk, ka-dunk.
I never hear it.
Really?
Maybe because...
We did. We actually took a bucket and we dropped it, and I have
a... Is it a plastic bucket or is it like a tin pail?
No. Oh, it needs to be a tin pail.
That's what I keep thinking of.
Okay. You need to hear like, you know, like the farm lady drop the bucket full of milk. That's right. All right.
I need a visual of it. Yeah. By the way, I cannot tell you how frustrating it is to... Because I've been listening to the podcast on my drive to and from work, right?
Yeah.
Because it's the only time I have available to just listen to something. Right. But
hopefully it's okay. Hopefully your drive has been okay.
No, the drive is – I love listening to it. But it's frustrating because this is such a visual discussion, right?
Right.
And I can't see all these things and I keep wanting to bookmark everything you're doing, like when you're watching an Amazon video.
Oh, right.
And they pull up with all the actors and all the different scenes. It's like I want to have all of those things available as you're walking through the podcast. So.
Well, you can, and I try to, on the podcast page.
You get the links, yeah.
Links there so people can go. So people should know that. But yeah, you should do that. Actually, you know what would be cool is you can give them for people on this one, get a gallery of some cool stuff you've done through your career. We can look at some of your old Eric Owen Moss stuff, some of the stuff you're doing at Gensler. You're doing some big
projects.
Big projects. With the Cowboy Training Center was the last thing that came out. And you're doing a lot of sports stuff, right?
Yeah, we did. I worked with a sports group for about 6 years now. We did Farmers Field, and we did a competition for Atlanta Falcons that I was heartbroken over. But, you know, and we farmed out those renderings, but we built all the medals in-house, and Daniel Seagraves helped us do all the computational design on that. But Kilograph did the renderings, and I think they were amazing.
Oh, Kilograph's great.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Do you guys ever use Mir?
I have not used Mir. They got amazing work as well.
Yeah.
Luxagon did some stuff for us in New York that was stunning. And I don't think they put it on their website because I think there was some copyright issues. But
they
threw Batman in the thing and he was crushing a car. It was amazing work.
Yeah, that's cool. So. But Kilograph's really cool. They're really cool. They're local, right?
Yeah, they are.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, now I'm going to definitely want the last
one. Okay.
All right. Thanks, guys.
All right. Thanks, Chris.